Thank you for joining us for this month's Fraud Talk. This is Mandy Moody, the media manager here at the ACFE. And today I will be talking to a good friend and CFE, Hal Humphreys, out of Nashville, Tennessee. And he is the lead investigator at Find Investigations. So welcome, Hal.
Thank you, Mandy. How are you today?
I'm good. So I kind of asked around the office and asked some other people, you know, what questions do you have for a private investigator? And if you could ask them anything, what would it be? And of course, I got back a lot of funny questions about, you know, Tom Selleck's mustache and things like that. But we're going to talk about the serious stuff with a little bit of the funny stuff and kind of how you came about your line of work and where you started and how a lot of our members, which are private investigators and CFEs, how they're, you know, kind of staying up to date on the latest trends. So tell me a little bit about your history and what made you want to become a private investigator.
Well, I started when I got out of college. My father was a real estate appraiser. I grew up in the real estate appraisal business. And I interned with a commercial real estate appraiser in Nashville, Tennessee, directly out of college. And I appraised real estate for about 20 years. I did commercial real estate valuation kind of nationwide. And I kind of stumbled into the PI world. I had a friend who was an attorney asked me to look into some assets that he thought one of his clients' opponents was trying to hide. I did a little bit of research and located, I think, 30-something properties that this guy had divested himself of over the period of about 6 months, right before he filed for bankruptcy to try and, you know, keep those assets from being discovered. And the attorney friend said, "Man, that's great work. You should become a private investigator." And I thought, well, how hard can that be? And I looked into it. And at the time in Tennessee, it wasn't terribly difficult to get a PI license, so I followed through with it and started the PI company.
As far as how you gained the education that you needed, how did you go about that?
Well, it's kind of interesting that the real estate appraisal world and the private investigations world, the skill set is virtually identical. As an appraiser, I tried to locate people, interview them, discover facts about a transaction or a piece of property, analyze those facts, and draw a conclusion. And it's the same skill set that I use every day as a private investigator. And one of the interesting things is when I was looking for a way to set myself apart as a private investigator, looking for a professional designation or something that I could add to my resume that would bolster a little bit, that's when I stumbled across the ACFE. And the interesting thing with the ACFE for me is I did some research, discovered the ACFE, looked into it, and, you know, went through the process of getting my designation and all of that stuff. It ends up being the perfect fit with the appraisal background and the certified fraud examiner designation. It's actually helped my business, my PI business, immensely having those two things in my background.
What does the typical day look like for you?
There's really not a typical day. There are two or three primary areas that I focus on as an investigator. First and foremost is fraud examination. I'm a contract investigator for the state of Tennessee for real estate, mortgage, and appraisal fraud. If the state of Tennessee is concerned about an issue of fraud, either in the appraisal world or in the mortgage lending world, they will bring me in to look at the case and see if there are any indications of fraud there. That's the bulk of my work. I also do a good deal of criminal defense work. In that arena, I spend a lot of time traveling. I spend a lot of time in Texas working on capital defense cases out there, and then some amount of time in Florida and Ohio working on post-conviction capital appeals for the federal defender's office in those areas. So that's basically, I've split my practice into two kind of distinct areas of fraud examination and then criminal defense work, which are kind of, I don't know, opposing, but I like both of the works.
So what do you think is one of the biggest misconceptions people have about private investigators?
Trench coats, fedoras, and pipes.
None of those are true? Not one?
None of those are true. It's funny. When I tell someone I'm a private investigator, I usually get one of two or three responses. One is, oh my God, I would be so good at that. I could totally be a private investigator. Or the other one is, are you watching me right now? And it's funny. People have these ideas, these preconceived notions about what a private investigator is. We did a podcast several months ago for Pursuit Magazine, which is a magazine that I publish with a partner that's for private investigators. And the first podcast we did was PI Perceptions and how people view private investigators. And we actually had, you know, Eli Rosenblatt, Kelly Paxton, Brian Willingham, all talking about the fact that when you tell someone you're a private investigator, people think some crazy things. You know, Kelly told a story about, you know, somebody thought that she was the person peeking into people's windows and taking pictures, which no legitimate private investigator would even do.
One of the questions somebody asked around here was, have you ever had to wear a disguise? So I'm guessing you haven't ever had to wear a disguise?
I have.
You have?
I have on occasion put on a hard hat and a vest in order to not stick out like a sore thumb in certain situations. You know, part of the fun of being a licensed real estate appraiser is a lot of times I don't even have to have a disguise. I just tell people, hey, I'm a real estate appraiser and I'm here, you know, inspecting this building, and they let you go right in. But I have on occasions put on the hard hat and the vest and walked onto a job site to see what was going on the job site. And, you know, it's pretty funny. You find if you just walk into a situation with authority and like you know what's going on, most people don't ask questions.
So what do you think is, you know, what contributes or what do you think are aspects of the skill set of a private investigator? Like, what makes you successful at it? I know you said it's similar to being an appraiser, but what are those skills?
It's also similar to being a journalist. My wife is a journalist. She works for National Public Radio and some other, you know, some national magazines and a couple of local magazines. And we hang out with a bunch of journalist friends. And the skill set's pretty similar to that as well. It's curiosity, a need to find out as many facts about a thing as you can. And then, you know, quite honestly, I really just enjoy talking to people and getting them to tell me their story.
What is one of the strangest things you've ever had to investigate?
Strangest thing I've ever had to investigate. I got a call one Saturday morning from a friend of a friend, and he said, I've just had my truck broken into. I've had about $50,000 worth of photographic equipment taken out of my truck. Can you help me? And I told him, I said, that's not really the kind of work I do. And he said, come on, man, your company is called Find Investigations. Can't you help me find my stuff? So I said, sure, I'll give it a whirl. Long story short, I used a couple of Craigslist keyword/crawler tricks to keep track of equipment that matched his equipment in the town where his equipment was stolen. We were able to locate his stuff within, I think, about 8 hours. I had actually driven up to the small town north of Nashville and bought back some of the guy's stuff. I ended up getting arrested that night for possession of stolen goods because the police officers that came to the scene later weren't real happy with me, what they perceived as doing their work. Then I got unarrested at about 2 o'clock in the morning when the detective on call came in and said, you've got video of this guy? And I said, yeah, and showed him the video. And he said, nice work. And we ended up working with the police to set up another buy the next day where they, you know, we arranged to meet with a guy at a specific spot and the police came and arrested him. So it was a pretty interesting case. It was crazy. I'm not a big fan of being in handcuffs.
So did you have any, you know, when you've transitioned from one career to another, did you have any, looking back now, humorous things, like growing pains where you really had to live it to learn from it?
Yeah. I mean, anytime you start something new and you're not really, there aren't a lot of places to go to get information on how to be a private investigator. Most people, their only idea of what a private investigator is going to be Magnum or Rockford or possibly Quincy ME, something like that, some TV show or movie, and they think that's what it's like, and it's really not. I stumbled a number of times when I first started the business, but I also realized pretty quickly that I'm just not the best guy to do surveillance work. My skill set and my background is more in due diligence and financial analysis than it is sitting in a car sweating and taking pictures of someone.
So you learned that along the way, you know, kind of where you were stronger.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing is, you know, when you take the time to get a certified fraud examiner's ticket and you take 20-something years to get experience in one very specific field of expertise, when you do those things, you can charge a premium for your work. When you're just a surveillance guy, and I don't mean just a surveillance work, when all you do is surveillance work, you're out there competing with people that will do surveillance work for $30 an hour. Surveillance is surveillance. I mean, you could be the best surveillance operative in the world, and you're probably not going to get much more than $75 an hour, maybe $100 an hour in certain jurisdictions. But in Tennessee specifically, I know the range is generally around $30 to $75 an hour for surveillance work.
So do you ever face any legal issues as far as tracking or even, I guess, photos and film? I mean, do you kind of have to, and if you go to different states even, do you see those laws change and are you constantly having to be up to date on those?
Yeah, there are things we have to do. Now, as far as tracking goes, if you're doing surveillance, I mean, there are about, I don't know how many private investigators there are in the country, but however many there are that many different opinions on GPS tracking. I am of the opinion that GPS tracking is not the best practice. In Tennessee, I think it's a misdemeanor to attach a GPS tracker to a car. There are attorneys that interpret that law to say that, you know, if I own the car, I can attach a GPS tracker to it. I'm not comfortable with it for legal reasons, number one. And number two, I think it makes for lazy investigations. If you're doing surveillance work, I think you need to have, you know, eyes on the subject and know where they are, be able to speak to that if you get into court. As far as taking pictures and video, if someone's in a public place, I'm not aware of any prohibition of taking pictures of them in a public place, and doing so surreptitiously is not a problem. If they have no expectation of privacy. Now, I would not be comfortable putting a camera inside someone's bedroom or inside someone's bathroom or someone's house in a place where they had an expectation of privacy. I did have an investigator working for me years ago that got a call to install a hidden camera at a house. And let me see if I can remember this story. The husband had hired us and he was going out of town and his wife was going to be left at home with the kids for the weekend. And he was concerned that she was smoking marijuana while she was taking care of the kids. So we set up a camera in the garage, and the way we established that they had no expectation of privacy there is the garage was facing the street. Every kid in the neighborhood felt comfortable coming in and opening that garage and grabbing toys or go-karts or what out of it. It was pretty well a public area. So we installed a hidden camera in the garage, and sure enough, when the husband was out of town, I think the number was 78 times over the course of 4 days that the mom / wife came out into the garage and hit the pipe.
Well, it's hard to parent alone, I can tell you that.
It's a tough job, and I get that, you know, yeah, I see where you're going with that. But, you know, the legalities of stuff like that are, I mean, if you do a little bit of research, you can find those things out. The biggest thing I deal with is if I'm interviewing someone in a criminal defense case, interviewing a witness pre-trial, there are a lot of times that I will have a recorder in my pocket. Now, in Tennessee and in Texas, those are both one-party consent states. I'm allowed to record a conversation that I'm a party to. In Florida, it's two-party consent. Both parties have to say, yes, I acknowledge that this is being recorded and I don't mind. So if I'm in Florida, I can't use that recorder in the same way. So those are the, and you got to keep track of those things to do the work. And I find that the little digital voice recorder is, like I said earlier, it's one of my favorite tools. It is the thing that allows me to keep my brain on track. And, you know, if I'm in an interview, a lot of times I will take notes, but I've got atrocious handwriting and my notes are generally just kind of to keep me on track and in a certain direction. And I can use that audio. There's a program, there's an app called Rev, R-E-V, rev.com. You can upload audio to Rev and they will transcribe it and send you back a transcription within, I think it's 24 hours.
Wow. That's good to know.
Yeah, it's fantastic service.
I imagine, as with a lot of CFEs that get into, you know, work that can be difficult and challenging and kind of wear on you a little bit, what, you know, kind of, how do you check it at the door, you know, when you get home or leave it at the office? You know, do you have tips on how you've kind of been able to separate what you're doing at work, or if you've interviewed something that was really tough to hear, or, you know, kind of how do you deal with that?
There are two things that I do to kind of deal with those issues. One is, you know, as I'm working, especially on a criminal defense case or even a fraud case that's about to go to trial, the closer it gets to trial, the less time I have for personal life. So there are times that it's 16, 18 hour days for sometimes 2, 3, 4 weeks at a time. At the end of that, alcohol and several days off seems to help. The other thing is, you know, if you go out and do an interview and you've talked to someone and you've found out something particularly bad or something, like you said, that it's hard to hear, I mean, you know, it's kind of like being in an emergency room, I guess. There's some degree of gallows humor that you have to deal with those things. And then sometimes it's just so heinous that you gotta go sit and be alone for a little bit. But by and large, for me, I find that, and this works for my wife as well, we're both basically self-employed, and we will work for months on end really hard on as many projects as we can, and then we'll take 7 weeks off and leave the country. And at that point, not only do I not think about the work, I can't think about it because I can't log in and check email and call clients back. So I strongly recommend for anyone who's working in any position, at least every 2 years, take 7 weeks off.
So somebody here asked if you have ever grown a mustache as thick as Tom Selleck. And I can actually say that you have.
I would even say that I've got one up on Tom Selleck because my beard is fairly substantial.
Yeah, you still have your beard?
The beard abides.
What piece of advice do you have for maybe somebody who's, you know, just graduated college? I know that you kind of switched into this 20 years after college, but, you know, people that are thinking about this as a career and kind of weighing the pros and cons, what advice do you have for them?
I think the best advice I would have for someone that wants to get into private investigations is learn, I would almost say, get a job where you can learn as much about a specific discipline as possible. For instance, go to work for the state, go to work for a bank, go to work for, you know, some institution where you can learn as much as possible and get that kind of boots on the ground education. because it's really difficult, I would think, to come straight out of college and start as a PI. Now, there are some PI firms that will hire young people to come on and train them and do a great job of that. There are some, you know, pretty much all across the country, you can find some bigger firms that can do that. But most PI firms that I'm familiar with and that I deal with on a daily basis are, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 people in the office. And they don't have the resources to take on a trainee. They don't have the resources to take people on. And if they do want someone to come on, they want someone that, that knows what they're doing immediately. Realistically, a lot of private investigators are retired law enforcement. And, you know, obviously, if you've got 20 years in law enforcement, you've got a very specific skill set and you've got, you know, a career of investigating things. And those guys make really good investigators. But a lot of times they come to it with a prosecutorial mind. And private investigators, by and large, are going to be working for defense teams or private entities and not for the prosecution, because the prosecution has in-house investigators and people to do those jobs. So, you know, there's a place for young, smart investigators who come out of some other business, some other profession, that can bring stuff to the table that maybe law enforcement guys can't bring to the table, like a knowledge of entrepreneurial business, a knowledge of, you know, how actual businesses work. And especially for fraud examiners, that's great to have.
Yeah, that's true. Well, wonderful. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Mandy, thank you for having me on. I've enjoyed the chat.
And I look forward to hearing you at the upcoming 26th annual ACFE Global Fraud Conference in Baltimore. And you can also check out how he will be having a breakout session. So you can hear him talk about the low-tech ways that investigators can get information. So we will see you in Baltimore.
Thank you, Mandy.
Thank you to Hal, and thank you to everyone listening to this month's episode of Fraud Talk. You can find all of our podcasts on acfe.com/podcast. We will talk to you next month.